Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The uncommon intelligence and great perspicacity of one of our favorite regular contributors, Diana West, is much in need at the moment. Diana, of course, is one of the country's preeminent thinkers about, scholars of, writers on, Russia, and before it, the Soviet Union, and what it has done over the years to subvert American security interests. So who better to talk to than she about the recent Trump-Putin summit? Diana West is, of course, the author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. She is also a contributor to The Daily Caller and writes a fabulous blog at dianawest.net. She is a regular, as I say, here at Secure Freedom Radio, for which we are very grateful. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. A lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about. So what should we think, as you see it, about the Trump-Putin summit? And specifically, I'm less interested, frankly, in the toing and froing about does the president trust the U.S. intelligence community or doesn't he, though he is certainly with John Brennan and his ilk running it for a time there, reason not to do so. But let me ask you about the Putin agenda, which he spoke of and suggested the president had largely agreed to, at least to discuss, of course, but seemingly more than that, as he laid it out in his opening remarks at the press conference after their summit.
Well, I think that with all of these back and forth machination statements and counterstatements and walking backs, I think that we have to understand that what we are looking at is nothing, what we are seeing on the surface is not what we should be extracting from these statements and events. I think that there is a lot of playing in the darkness, in the backstage areas, in the subtext. And with that, I think the Putin agenda, whatever it is stated to be, is to constrain, undermine, and subvert the president of the United States, whoever he will be, whoever he is.
As part of the practice of trying to do all of that to the country more broadly, right?
Absolutely. This is another point to understand when you're looking at these events, is the sense that this is a continuum. This is not just the Trump presidency. This is not just the Putin era. This is a continuum of the past century since the Russian Revolution. Looking at it that way, I think what we're looking at is a tremendous effort to understand Trump, failing that to envelop him in this charm offensive, in this absolute cultivation of him, which I hope he is able to understand and resist. But I think that this is all very sinister coming out of Russia. I think it is all very sinister coming out of the New York Times, to be quite frank. This is a very difficult situation. We have I think the most intuitive president we've ever had, one of the most intuitive individuals on the national stage, in Donald Trump. He acts, he does, he thinks, he perceives in ways that are very difficult to understand, and I think, frankly, have confounded his enemies at home and in Moscow.
Well, it's no question about that. There's a lot of confounding going on. Very quickly, Diana, the president was treated, and I think very much in keeping with what you've just said about Putin's agenda of manipulating, dividing, subverting, to a statement by Putin at the summit press conference to the effect that he actually did favor Donald Trump during the election campaign. I don't know where the truth lies on this, but it does strike me that a person who would have been much more attractive to Putin, a person who would have proven much more malleable in the presidency as she had as the Secretary of State, would have been Donald Trump's opponent, Hillary Clinton. Don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that it all comes down to the difference on nuclear weaponry to understand this best. Donald Trump's foreign policy, one of his pillars of his foreign policy as announced during the 2016 campaign, was to upgrade, expand, and modernize our nuclear arsenal. Hillary Clinton, on the contrary, said the last thing that we needed was to modernize, to bring online a new generation of nuclear-armed cruise missiles. This was a statement of hers that she made on the campaign trail, I believe at a fundraiser. That could not be more diametrically opposed from Donald Trump's. And if you're sitting in the Kremlin, truly, who would you rather have, a nuclear-improved and superior United States or someone who is following the Obama trajectory on the decline?
Yeah, unilateral nuclear disarmament of the United States. And then there's, Diane West, you've pointed out, in keeping with your thesis in American Betrayal, that Hillary Clinton was also one of the architects of this unbelievable transfer of militarily relevant technology in this caper called Skolkovo. And then there's the Uranium One business. There's much evidence that there was real collusion taking place on her part long before the election, and presumably would have been something Putin would have been happy to continue. Let me ask you about one other thing, Diana West. You sort of keep your eye on the culture wars. One of the things that I believe is going on here is the big lie being perpetrated that what's explaining Donald Trump's sometimes confounding positions and statements about Russia is that Putin has something on him. We're hearing that now from not just, you know, commentators like Joe Scarborough, but from Nancy Pelosi and I believe Chuck Schumer. There's no evidence that I'm aware of, but it is nonetheless being endlessly repeated now. Talk a little bit about the big lie and the role that it plays in sort of totalitarian operations like the one I think being operated against President Trump.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very common technique of all totalitarians, of all dictators, of all people who are seek not to shed truth and light, but to undermine and confound, to use that word, to manipulate, to create hysteria. I mean, the idea that President Putin, what is he called? I don't even know. Dictator Putin has dirt on Donald Trump. And not Hillary Clinton, and not Bill Clinton going back, for example, to his 1969-70 trip to Moscow and Prague. I mean, going back to all of these people, Schumer, etc., it shows you that what we're looking at is that very extremely important Soviet tradecraft of framing, whereby you create a persona and you cut out all relevant context. If you are truly concerned about what a foreign adversary has on an American president, then you are concerned about what they have on every other public official or important national figure who is significant in the conduct of our country.
Or you should.
Well, if you are truly concerned, if you are not just using it as a weapon, then you are looking at all of Soviet influence, all of Russian influence, all of Chinese influence on both parties, on all figures.
Oh, Diana, there's so much more to talk with you about. We are hard out of time. Let's pick up again next week. And thank you very much for your visit with us today. In the meantime, stay well, and thank you for all that you're doing at dianawest.net, the Daily Caller, and elsewhere, as well as in your visits with us. Next up, we'll explore some more of this sorry story with Peter Pry, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by one of the country's truly great authorities on matters involving nuclear deterrence, weapons, the threat that is posed to this country by those in enemy hands, notably, but not exclusively, by the way, to our electric grid. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has rendered an extraordinary amount of service to our country, initially as an analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency. He has also gone on to serve on several different congressional staffs and commissions set up by Congress, including most especially as the staff director of an extraordinarily important commission to examine the threat of electromagnetic pulse. He is a friend, an author, an ally, and a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned. It's always a delight to welcome him back. Peter Pry, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. Always a pleasure to be interviewed by someone so well-informed as yourself.
Well, thank you. Let me ask you about this summit business. We talked a little bit in the previous segment with Diana West about it, but I'm interested in drilling down, especially with you, Peter, on the pieces of the Putin agenda to which he claims the president has agreed that are very problematic with respect to our national security. And I'm thinking specifically of his efforts to paper over Russia's violations of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, his ideas about extending the New START deal, despite the fact they seem poised to break out of that as well, the modernization of his nuclear forces more generally, and the efforts that he's continuing, as the Soviets did before his time, to constrict our missile defenses and the ability to defend ourselves from space. What do you make of all of that, and how should Donald Trump proceed?
Well, what I make of it is that Putin is indeed a KGB, former KGB agent and master of manipulation and disinformation and entrapment. And while I'm an admirer of the president and a supporter of the president, clearly I think he was outplayed in the chess game, at least rhetorically. Hopefully he'll walk back some of these things and not go forward with them, because all of these things would be fatal to U.S. national security. The Russians have cheated on all these treaties, in addition to cheating on the INF treaty. They're on the verge of a breakout. In fact, the number of weapons they've actually got deployed under New START, according to one of the best in the business who does these counting, Dr. Mark Schneider, former Department of Defense official, are already in excess of what is allowed under New START. In our own State Department, these proposals are made all the more dangerous because we've got so many Obama holdovers in still in government, and people in the State Department, who are still there, advising the Trump administration that they are very susceptible. They never saw a treaty, even a bad treaty, that they didn't want to sign on to.
Yeah, and actively negotiate. Peter Pry, we've actually had Dr. Mark Schneider on twice this week talking about these things, but I did want to ask you specifically about a point that he has made on our air, namely that what the Russians are up to in terms of building new nuclear capabilities may essentially make even less relevant the restrictions should they decide to abide by them on New START. And you've written a paper for us about something that apparently is being called the Poseidon weapon system, which along with hypersonics and maneuvering warheads and the like is very threatening indeed. Tell us a little bit about it and why it is of such concern.
Yes, it's this contrasts this kumbaya moment to re-embrace these various arms control treaties that would have the effect of limiting and crippling President Trump's strategic modernization program, limiting and crippling our ability to deploy like space-based defenses and improve our missile defenses, because that's the history of arms control, and that's why Russia and Putin want them so badly, at least rhetorically, because they break them, they violate them, and they get away with that for years, and the State Department covers it all up and advance their numbers and the sophistication of their arsenal while we obey the treaties beyond the letter and allow our capabilities to atrophy. And one classic example of this, this one missile, back on March 1st, Putin described to a world television a whole series of new nuclear super weapons that Russia has under development, some of them imminently deployable. And among these, one of the most disturbing was called a Poseidon, which is a really revolutionary system. It's a robot submarine equipped with a 100 megaton warhead, which is the most powerful nuclear weapon ever deployed. It's a 10,000 times more powerful than a Hiroshima bomb, 100 megatons. It's 1,000 times more powerful than the standard U.S. hydrogen bomb. And it's designed to autonomously basically roam around the world's oceans. And at least according to the Russians, what the Russians claim it's for, is to create tsunamis over 300 feet high, radioactive, that would flood and irradiate eastern areas of the United States, rendering them radioactive and uninhabitable for centuries. And if that isn't scary enough, it's the first superweapon that combines this this unprecedentedly powerful warhead with artificial intelligence. It's an artificially intelligent doomsday machine is what it amounts to. And I had written an article before the summit. I was hoping the president would put down his foot and say no to this thing. This is an unprecedented escalation. Indeed, Henry Kissinger, I'm not a big fan of the Atlantic, and not that much of Henry Kissinger either, but on this I agree with him. He wrote an article in The Atlantic in June called How the Enlightenment Ends, warning against that governments, you know, are going to misuse artificial intelligence in the future by focusing too much on its application to defense systems. And in fact, this is the exact kind of thing he was warning about before the ink is dry on the Kissinger article. The Russians are already experimenting with an artificially intelligent doomsday machine. We don't need this. The world doesn't need this. We shouldn't let our grandchildren and our children be threatened by this system. I wish the president would have said, if you try deploying that, we're going to sink it. You know, this one is a red line we don't need, or our fates will depend on some Russian software engineer getting it right, at least. You know, it's bad enough, even if it works. But what if it doesn't work right?
Peter, there's so much to talk about on that score, but I do want to move along with a couple of other things before I let you go. One is earlier this week, the 16th of August, was the anniversary of the Trinity explosion, which launched the atomic age, as you know, the weapons that were ultimately used to destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the fruits of that early effort of the Manhattan Project. I wondered if I could just draw on your experience and expertise on these matters, Peter, to just ask the question. That was a test. We went on to do quite a number of them subsequently, but we haven't done any nuclear weapons tests at all since 1992. That is to say, underground, realistic experiments. How important do you think it is to the credibility of our existing nuclear deterrent, to say nothing of its modernization, which is long overdue, that we have the ability to resume some limited underground nuclear testing?
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. John Foster, you know, who's the free world's foremost nuclear weapons expert. He designed most of the nuclear weapons that are in inventory, and with Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, who had been the director of the U.S. Defense Nuclear Agency, responsible for modernizing and maintaining the reliability and effectiveness of our nuclear weapons, that in the long run, nuclear testing is really indispensable to maintaining a safe and reliable nuclear deterrent. And we were talking before about this is just a sterling example of how the United States is meticulous to adhering not just to the letter of any agreement it assigns, but going beyond that, going beyond it, because there isn't even a treaty. We never signed a comprehensive test ban treaty that requires us to do this. It was just an understanding, a mutual understanding between the United States and Russia. And yet, the understanding didn't prohibit all underground nuclear testing. Hydrodynamic nuclear testing, which is very low yield, was permitted, and the Russians have continued to do that. That's what they've been doing.
Yeah, and have used it to modernize their entire arsenal, and we've been hamstrung because we've said no testing of any kind, absolutely zero yield.
That's right, and so for 25 years they've stolen a technological march on us, and because of this disparity, we do no testing at all. They've done the hydrodynamic underground testing. That's enough to enable them to deploy what are called third generation nuclear weapons. They're nuclear weapons that are specialized for effects like electromagnetic pulse or pure fusion weapons that produce no fission on the battlefield. very low yields so that they're practical and usable, much more powerful than conventional weapons, but basically safe to use because they don't produce radioactive fallout. X-rays for anti-ballistic missile and anti-aircraft purposes and anti-satellite purposes, we don't have anything like that. And they openly write about the existence of these weapons, and that's what they've deployed.
We've got to get this right, Peter Pryor. I couldn't agree with you more. We've made terrible mistakes on nuclear testing in the past, and if we don't have the capacity to resume it, it would be a disaster, I think, for the future deterrent posture of the United States. Peter, we are hard out of time. We just have to let you go. Thank you very much for all that you do and are doing these days at the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, advising the United States Congress. You are truly a national treasure, and we look forward to visiting with you again in the very near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Daniel Pipes. We'll take stock with him on what is happening with the Middle East and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Daniel Pipes. He is an extraordinary resource on a whole host of issues, but most especially about matters involving the Middle East and American interests there, security, geostrategic, economic, and the like. He is the founder and president of a splendid organization based in Philadelphia, the Middle East Forum. He has written more books than I can count, quite frankly. I think it's up to 17 or something like that. He is the driving force behind an extraordinary effort, which I have always found to be very compelling, and I'm pleased to say seems to be picking up some steam, as we'll talk about with him in a minute, called Israel Victory. And it's a different way of thinking about and hopefully pursuing the prospects for peace in the Middle East between Israel and its adversaries. But before we get to all of that, let me say welcome, Daniel Pipes. Good to have you back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
You know, I'm very interested. We're talking in the course of the program a bit about this former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, who is much in the news of the moment for some really over-the-top tweeting he's been doing. But, Daniel, you've followed very closely for years and with great effect the Muslim Brotherhood and its civilization jihad, as they call it, inside the United States, a big part of which is, of course, as you know, influence operations. And I just wonder if you might comment on John Brennan's enabling of those operations, particularly when he was serving as the Homeland Security Advisor to the President.
John Brennan is typical of left-wing academic views of Islam. He could be teaching at some university. He is an apologist for Islamism. He sees no connection between jihad and violence. He sees jihad as a defensive mechanism. This is the academy. He is someone who studied the Middle East. Actually, he and I are contemporaries, and we were roaming around the Middle East in the early 70s. I never met him, but about the same time. He should have gone on to an academic career, but somehow or other he ended up in government, and he has applied these crazy academic thoughts to government and done great harm.
One of the things that I'm particularly struck by is when he was in that job at the White House of Homeland Security Advisor, I believe it was in November of 2011, he entertained a demand from Muslim Brotherhood front groups, some 50 of them, and other sort of leftist fellow travelers, to purge from the lexicon and training and trainers on matters involving the threat we're facing from jihadism of any reference to Sharia supremacism, to the ties it all has to the teachings of Islam and the like. And I just wonder, as a professional in this space, Daniel Pipes, when you are not able to understand the nature of the enemy you're up against, what is the likelihood you're going to be able to do much of a job in defeating them?
I think to ask that question is to answer it. I've been saying for a couple of decades that just as a physician cannot treat and heal a disease without identifying and naming it, so strategists cannot defeat an enemy without identifying and naming the enemy. And from the get-go, we haven't done that. We had the war on terror on the 11th of September 2001.
But Daniel, I mean, in a way, it's worse than that, because to use your analogy, you've got a physician that is actually engaged in malpractice. It's not just that he's ignorant or he's not correctly applying the right, you know, methods. He's actively misconstruing and misapplying whatever remedies and making it impossible for others. In this case, the military, the intelligence community, the Homeland Security, our front lines of defense, to prevent them from doing this job. Hardly a guy that you would take instruction from on matters of treason, one would think. Let me turn to another issue, Daniel. You have recently been spending some time in Eastern Europe or Central Europe, and specifically have been exploring what you call the civilizationist parties that have been widely defamed, I think it's fair to say, by the press and the left here in the United States. Who are these people, and what is their agenda, and what is the import of it for folks like us, for that matter?
They are what the press calls far right or populist or nationalist. I don't think any of those terms are terribly accurate. So I came up with my own, which you just quoted, civilizationalist. And what I mean by that is they're focused on Western civilization. They're not nationalists. They're not trying to expand their borders. They're not far right because while they certainly have right qualities, they also have left qualities, especially when it comes to the economy. And populism, well, yeah, they're sometimes populist, but also there are left-wing parties that are populist, so that doesn't really work.
It may be that they're popular, which is not necessarily the same thing, because they're advancing Western civilization.
They're focused on immigration and Islamization. And I think as of December 2017, they are on the move. Nothing happened for year after year. They never got anywhere. But in December last year, without much note, one of these parties formed a government in Austria. Then in June, another one formed a party in Italy. Now, that's an addition to Central Europe, the old Cold War West, Eastern Europe, where in Poland, Hungary, Czechia, and Slovakia, they are already in power. So six out of the European Union's 28 members now have civilizationalist parties either in charge or as part of the government. And I think they're coming along in greater numbers. I think in France, I can see Sweden, Germany, Netherlands, I can see similar developments. I won't be surprised if within, say, 6-8 years, half of the European Union is made up of governments that have civilizationalist elements in them, and, you know, about time. Now, they're flawed. They're very flawed. They work with Putin. They're autocratic. They have anti-Semitic elements, anti-Christian elements, anti-Muslim elements, you name it, fascist elements. They have many flaws. But just let me conjure up the name Jeremy Corbyn. You know, the other side has flaws, too. So while they have flaws, I think it's important to work with them. Rather than to condemn them.
Daniel, to the extent you've been spending time with them and having an opportunity to interact with them, do you credit the argument that I've heard that many of these are in some way, shape, or form, you know, associating themselves with Putin, not out of a particular enthusiasm for Putin, let alone his agenda, or an ignorance of what role he and his predecessors have played in their countries, but because the United States has largely chosen not to engage with them or otherwise support their causes. Is that at work here, do you think, or not?
Well, to put it more generally, they are hard up for support, not just American, but in general support. So they find the support where they can, and Putin finds them useful. But, you know, I rue that. I wish they didn't do that. I wish they didn't do a lot of things. But whatever their faults, they are doing something very important.
Yeah, for their own people, and I believe for the Western world more generally. Daniel, two other quick questions. The latest, as you see it, on Turkey. I'm told as we speak that the Turks have continued the outrageous confinement of Pastor Andrew Brunson. And it suggests that this is a regime that is not only indifferent to justice, but particularly hostile to the United States. How do you see Erdogan moving forward at this point with his new election mandate and powers?
Erdogan has been dictator of Turkey for about 5 years now. The elections on June 24th were simply a validation, a legalization, but they made no difference. He is in total charge. He does what he wants, whether it's in the economy or in the military or jailing or whatever it might be. He's in charge. Nothing much has changed. The only real important development is that his wacky economic ideas are now putting the country's economy in jeopardy, and it appears that Turkey is heading for a fall because of his crazy ideas. The Turkish lira is the only opposition left, but he does what he wants with the Russians, with the jailing pastors, you name it. He's in total charge.
Yeah. And he is a Sharia supremacist who is very much playing for the other side in this civilization struggle. Daniel Pipes, lastly, talk to me quickly about your work on the whole cause of Israel victory.
Israel victory is an idea I've developed that wars end when one side gives up. And in this case, if you look closely at the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Israelis have won by any measure. They're just not acting it, and the Palestinians haven't realized it. And so what I'm hoping is that the U.S. government will at some point say to the Israeli government, win your war. Do what you need to do within moral, legal, and practical limits to convince the Palestinians that the gig is up, the war is over, they lost, you won, and let's move on.
And that would have implications, of course, not just for the so-called West Bank and the Palestinian Authority that more or less operates there, but also for Gaza, from which Israel has been subjected to a considerable amount of violent attack of late, not just at the defense line, but of course with rockets and mortars and fire kites, for that matter. This would be presumably what you're talking about, taking matters into their hands. And
it is good timing, because for weeks now, the Palestinians in Gaza had been sending off kites with firebombs and other devices to set fire to Israeli parks and farmlands and so forth. And the Israelis have just sat back. And so what we've been saying is, hey, do something, you know, cut off their electricity supplies. And finally, as of a couple of days ago, the Israelis did it. And today there's a report that Hamas has told the Palestinians to cool it with the incendiary kites.
Thank you for the leadership you're exhibiting on this, Daniel Pipes, as in so many other areas. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Marshall right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by one of the rock stars at an indispensable organization here in Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch. He is its senior investigator. His name is Bill Marshall. You can follow his writings, among other places, at American Thinker. He has been an investigator in government as well as in the private sector for most of his career. He's an extraordinary resource, and among the many important folks doing vital work at Judicial Watch, I think Bill is right at the head of the line. Bill, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
Great. Thanks for having me back, Frank.
I'm very keen on the work that you've been doing personally and corporately, Bill, on the Peter Strzok affair. This is, of course, the disgraced special agent of the FBI who testified and really put a face on the whole horror of an unaccountable and renegade deep state operating against, well, I would argue the national interest for sure, but certainly against the elected president of the United States and before that, the Republican candidate. even as he was mucking about with considerable effect in the Hillary Clinton investigation, which you've also been following closely. Give us sort of an update as you see it as to where we are on these various affairs and Peter Strzok's central role in them.
Right. Well, the testimony, as you and I were discussing, that the Strzok gave last week, I guess it's been now, it was just remarkable. I mean, he's the face of a rogue part of the executive branch of government. I would argue that we are in a political crisis that is tantamount to what this country faced in 1860. That may sound a little over the top, but you have the Justice Department, the FBI, and possibly elements of the intelligence community that have gone rogue. They've now mounted a rear guard action in the face of their defeat in November 2016. I think they are desperate to avoid disclosure of actions committed by Obama and Hillary Clinton, or the Clintons collectively. And they are the players in this deep state cabal are doing everything they can to prevent the full transparency and disclosure, because I think it would shock the conscience of the American people. Now, what Peter Strzok exemplified so well in his testimony before Congress is the arrogance and the condescension that they hold.
Contempt.
Absolute contempt of Congress, of the American people. He, I think, is just a product of James Comey, and before him, Robert Mueller, and certainly Andrew McCabe, fits into that category. These guys are themselves beneath contempt. They completely forgot that they are servants of the people,
putting their own agenda first, and doing it through the extraordinary abuse of power in the process. One example of what is, I believe, a very grievous abuse of power, Bill Marshall, is something that happened during the Obama presidency that involved the transfer of immensely sensitive technologies to Russia. And there's some people who were, call to mind Uranium-1, but I'm talking about an affair called Skolkovo, in which, as you know, there was a transfer of technology to help Russia have its own Silicon Valley, including things like hypersonic missile technology and various sophisticated computing capabilities. It was described as an overt technology theft operation by the Army and the Air Force. A man who was much in evidence in all of this affair is now calling the president out for treasonous activities, and I'm thinking of John Brennan. What do you make of his assertions at the moment, but also his past misconduct?
Right. Well, it's always rich to listen to John Brennan pontificate and rail against President Trump for his meetings with Vladimir Putin. When John Brennan voted for Gus Hall in the communist candidate for president of the United States in 1980, how this man ever received a security clearance, let alone rose to the top of the intelligence community as director of the CIA, it boggles the mind. And I have to attribute that to the fact that that President Obama was, if not a Marxist, then a socialist, in my humble opinion, and they were fellow travelers. But I think Brennan, again, my own view, I think this is the picture that's emerging, was that he was a principal architect of this plan to this intelligence operation, if you will, this influence operation, or to essentially undermine the Trump candidacy and now, the Trump presidency in what is amounting to effectively a legalistic coup d'etat. But I think he is one of the individuals who has a lot to hide, in relation to Skolkovo, Uranium-1, all of them, the machinations that were occurring during the Obama administration. Yeah.
The Muslim Brotherhood, too, let me be clear. This is a guy who was an enabler of its influence operations and it actually legitimated a lot of their party lines. He's a very dubious character, and I think for him to be casting the first stone is a mistake, not only wrong, but a mistake, because it ought to invite and receive a lot of very careful scrutiny. And if it's done, I think that it will be clear he's been engaged in this sort of wrongdoing in his own way that Peter Strzok has now been tagged for. Let me ask you about one other thing, Bill Marshall, before we have to let you go. There is much being made at the moment, including front page stories, if you please, about a woman who's been charged with being an agent of influence of Russia by the name of Maria Butina. And I'm interested in both what you make of this and the timing of it, but also the contrast between what seems to be pretty much amateur hour by this young woman with the very sophisticated and highly successful ring of covert agents that the Russians had put into place, apparently with success in penetrating the political machines of Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer, that was rolled up in an operation called Ghost Stories by the FBI back in 2010, I believe it was, and sent very, very promptly packing back to Russia, where they were given a hero's welcome by Putin. And the whole thing just stank of a cover-up. And I'd be interested in your thoughts as an investigative type as to whether we're being sort of misled into thinking there's some major problem underway at the moment. It's not to say that there aren't other agents of influence operating in the United States or other rings that are doing damage to us. But this particular individual, compared to the Ghost Stories types, strikes me as pretty small potatoes.
Yeah, she gives $100,000 or something. I believe it was she was the founder of this group, Right to Bear Arms, right? A Russia gun rights group, and they managed to get some photos taken with NRA members or something. I mean, if this is the best that the Russians can do in terms of an influence operation, then we don't have a whole lot to worry about. And as you note, it was just as in that very sophisticated operation against Hillary Clinton that the Russians had mounted, which was the subject of Operation Ghost Stories. They got very, very close to Hillary, and that was when the Obama National Security Establishment, the intelligence community, decided it was time to wrap that thing up before Hillary perhaps was actually compromised or someone very close to her. And I believe that they did in fact get close to someone who was very close to her in that case. And of course, as you note, the timing of all of these interesting events with respect to the indictment of the Russian GRU officials
on the eve of the summit meeting between Putin and Trump.
Yeah, it's like there's a conductor, in this cabal who's orchestrating all of these actions by our government to try to continue to undermine President Trump.
Oh, you sound like a conspiracy theorist. The trouble is that you actually have some facts behind the conspiracy theories, as opposed to the ones we're hearing much about Donald Trump having been blackmailed by the Kremlin, for which, as best I can tell, there is no evidence. Bill Marshall, we are out of time. There is so much more to talk about. I know that you will be continuing the great efforts you make at Judicial Watch to get to the bottom of these sorts of issues. And we appreciate your personal investigation and the extraordinary success of Judicial Watch in all of these thorny and often obstructed questions of getting justice served. Come back to us again very soon, and I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.